everybody. Oh, I could switch. Is this on now? Okay. Hi, everybody. My name's Sandy. I'm an alcoholic. And Dick, thank you for being the voice and for being our friend. We're delighted you're here. This is another talk that I don't normally give, but it was fun doing a little research on the Oxford group. I had the wrong take on a few points that I was glad that I learned the real understanding of it. We owe a lot to the Oxford group in terms of the start of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so it might be worth, just for history purposes, to do a little studying about what it was, because obviously producing Alcoholics Anonymous was not its claim to fame. They had much bigger fame they were looking after than getting a few drunks sober. But it seems that it all centered on one man, Frank Buchman. It's pronounced either way. I like Buchman. And he was born in 1878 in Pennsylvania, and he died in Germany in 1961. And in 1902, he became a Lutheran minister in Philadelphia. And he stayed there about 3 years and had a dispute with the board of directors of his church committee that were in charge of him. They didn't like what he was doing. So he went to England. And while he was there, just on a regular weeknight, he went to listen to a speaker, a woman speaker, and he was transformed in the middle of the talk. It's like totally unplanned events. And he immediately went back that night and wrote letters of amends to the committee that had fired him. And it reminds me of Dr. Bob. The first thing he did was make amends. You know, when he finished that surgery and then they wondered where he was, he spent the whole day making amends all over Akron. So there's something that must be intrinsic to spiritual awakenings that involve amends. And when you think about our eighth and ninth step, that's pretty powerful stuff happens there. The promises come in. And so he was moved, and the history said that he never heard from them. They didn't write back. But he made the amends. And then he came back to the States in 1909 and got a job as the secretary of the YMCA for the state of Pennsylvania. And at that time, the YMCA was a very evangelical organization spreading Christianity. And one of the things that he instituted within the YMCA there was quiet times. They had never had those before, and he just started just all sit quietly. You know how that drives us nuts at AA meetings. You've been there when the leader says, let's take a moment of silence followed by a serenity prayer, and they wait 10 seconds, and you can see the room getting nervous and more nervous. And somebody say something. But anyway, he initiated quiet times, which became part of our steps and part of the Oxford group. And then in 1915, he went to the Far East and spent a year spreading the word about Christianity, met Gandhi several times. And as we find out about Frank Buchman, if there's anything he loved, it was celebrities. The more famous you were, the better he wanted to be around. And as he got the idea for the spreading this new form of Christianity. He called it first century Christianity. His plan was the best way to spread anything is to get famous people in it, and then other people will come just to hang around the famous people. It's kind of like the Washingtonians did the same thing. They would get the mayor of a city to sign the pledge, and then they'd announce, we're having a parade, the mayor's heading the parade, why don't you all come? And here comes AA, just the opposite, you know, anonymity, no promotion. So you can see the difference starting right there. And he met Sam Shoemaker while he was on this trip. And there's a reported story, and Sam Shoemaker was the reverend of the church in New York that eventually became the headquarters of America's Oxford group. And he's a very powerful figure and wrote a lot of books. But at the time, he said to Frank Buckman, he said, you know, I'm not having a lot of luck in my sermons to the people over here. He says, you have any ideas? And he says, maybe you don't have anything to offer. And it caused Shoemaker to take a look at his own program and his own life. And he did make some transformations of his own and went on to become a very good preacher. But at the time, he wasn't reaching anybody. Then in 1917 to 1980, he was in China trying to convert China to Christianity. And, you know, it didn't have much success. He also spent a lot of time at the universities when he came up with the idea for first century Christianity at the Ivy League schools here and over in England at Oxford University. And eventually it caught on with a lot of the students that this would be the new cool in thing. Instead of church activity, we're going to be like the first century Christians. We're going to be on our own. We're going to meet together, unsupervised, without, you know, a minister, and just talk about these spiritual principles, become better people, etc. And there was no name for this organization. It was called First Century Christianity, which is not much of a name. And they were in South Africa in 1929, and he had brought a group from Oxford University. And they were on a train, and for whatever reason, the porter who was putting the baggage on the train marked the windows where these people were staying with the sign saying Oxford Group. And some press people saw that, and it caught on like that. It became the Oxford Group and stayed the Oxford Group until Oxford made them get rid of it later on when things went in the wrong direction. And so it was incorporated as the Oxford Group after that time. I think it was in 1933 or 4, they officially became the Oxford Group. Let me see. Also about this time, things were happening in Germany that were causing a lot of reflection in the world and in Europe. And if you recall, Germany, after World War I, had very oppressive retributions that they had to make to the other countries, especially France. And they were so oppressive that there was nothing left for the German people. You know, they would produce and they would work, and then it all went to other countries. And that was one of the things that Hitler used to springboard to power, was that he was going to allow the Germans to keep some of their own earnings, and we were going to make life better. And in the early years, there was this assessment that maybe this guy was going to really help Germany out, that he had some ideas. He was very anti-communist. And Buckman, you know, communism was anti-Christ and anti-religion, you know, it was just a thing that Buckman hated almost the most. So he saw Hitler as an anti-communist and a dynamic figure and someone who was trying to do something for the country. We hadn't progressed to where the true nature of Hitler came out. And so he was in Germany, tried to meet with Hitler, and was unable to, but he met with Himmler three or four times, and there was a number of Oxford groups in Germany. And Hitler at one point gave a speech where he was going to preserve Christianity. And so after Buckman left Germany, he was giving an interview with a reporter in New York. And he made a statement, and this is what he said: "I thank heaven for a man like Adolf Hitler, who built the front line of defense against the Antichrist of communism." And he was just making a comment that somebody like Hitler, if he would buy into first century Christianity, would be an amazing leader. And so he was almost speaking in allegorical terms, but he was taken as being a fan of Adolf Hitler. And of course, then Hitler starts invading countries and the true nature comes out. But Buckman was stuck with this statement that he made that really was taken a little bit out of context, but he decided not to correct it because he was worried about the Oxford groups in Germany, and there was three different types of groups, and one kind of tried to go along in order to survive, but a couple of them were wiped out, and some of their members went to the concentration camps, and it was kind of rough on them. This accounts for why Bill Wilson never talked that much about his debt to the Oxford group, which he felt very deeply as AA became on its own. You know, we're talking about 1939, the big book comes out, and the invasions are starting, Czechoslovakia and Poland and whatever. And so Bill decided that he was just going to be quiet about the role that the Oxford group played in AA, and he didn't really start talking about them until later. And this was the reason, that he was afraid that if he connected AA with the Oxford group, that new members, potential members, would feel that they weren't going to be joining the Nazi organization during World War II. And so I think he made the right decision, and I'm sure he was conflicted with it, that he couldn't really say how important the Oxford group was for us. After World War II, these are the Gestapo documents came to light. One from 1939, this is a quote: "The Oxford group preaches revolution against the national state and has quite evidently become its Christian opponent." So this is how the Nazis saw the Oxford groups in Germany, as troublemakers and people that you're going to have to get rid of. And then it said, "No other Christian movement has underlined so strongly the character of Christianity as being supernational and independent of all racial barriers." Well, this obviously wouldn't fly in Germany, so there was a lot of trouble with it. Then one other thing that gives the group a little feather in its hat, it said the Oxford group in Germany continued to oppose the Nazi regime during the war. In Norway, their lead bishop said in 1945, "I wish to state publicly that the foundations of the united resistance of Norwegian churchmen to Nazis were laid by the Oxford group's work." And so they were effective workers and were really all over the world. Okay. Now comes the name change. And the name change came right around this same time when Buckminn, 1938, Buckminn was making a speech in London. And he came up with this line that the crisis, speaking about the potential of this war, is fundamentally a moral one. The nations must rearm morally. Moral recovery is essential as the forerunner of economic recovery. And then some other person mentioned moral rearmament, and the next thing, he decided to change the name of the Oxford Group to Moral Rearmament. And under moral rearmament, it really got big. It really got all over the world. Let me see if I got a few. In England, a author wrote a book called Come Wind, Come Weather, describing this new way of life, moral rearmament, and dedicated it to Frank Buckminn. And she said, what they're doing up and down the country and helping men and women solve their problems and prepare them for whatever lies ahead will prove to be of national importance in the days to come. The book sold 650,000 copies in Britain alone. So there was it appealed to people who were puzzled by the nature of, here's another war, the same countries that just fought World War I, we're all going to be doing this again. How do you make sense out of life? And then somebody came up with, it's a moral problem. If we could get all the citizens in each of these countries to become moral themselves, all these problems would take care of themselves. Which, in a spiritual sense, is true. But to people who aren't interested in spirituality, it looks like child's play. It looks like, yeah, great, that's really wonderful, but give me a couple tanks. You know what I mean? Spirituality looks silly sometimes. AA looks silly. If you were, you know, just, well, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't have any money. I don't have a job. Just trust God. Oh. People who don't understand spirituality say, well, maybe you ought to look for a job, too, you know. Where we know that by trusting God, we can get calm. And when we get calm, our intuitive nature can kick in, and we'll start thinking about where that job actually is, that was in our subconscious, and we now have access to it. And we suddenly take an action that we never would have thought of under the stress of our situation. So there's always this thing when there's a website of some guy hates AA. It's called the Orange Papers or something like that. And he's devoted his whole life to anti-AA, this and that. And God, the amount of time he spends on it. But you can tell that he's only connected materially. And so when you look at spirituality from a material perspective, it does look silly. You know what I mean? You go to work, you earn some money, or you hang around and pray. And we know the power of prayer from having done it. But we can't explain it in a logical way why it changed our lives. So it's the practical versus the spiritual. Let's see what else we got here. When the war broke out, MRA workers joined the Allied forces in large numbers and were in many theaters of war. Others worked to heighten morale and to overcome bottlenecks. And I think somewhere in here. Oh, Harry Truman, yeah. In the United States, where moral rearmament was doing similar work, Senator, later President Harry Truman, chair of the Senate Committee on Investigating War Contracts, told the Washington press conference in 43, suspicions, rivalries, apathy, greed lie behind most of the bottlenecks. This is in defense contracts, so that we're trying to get, you know, organized for this effort. He said, this is where moral rearmament group comes in. And here we have Senator Truman making a speech about how moral rearmament straightened everything out between the contracts, the unions, the government, by appealing to each side to let's approach this on a moral basis. Let's all, let's work on the principle not of who's right, but of what's right. So it sounds amazing that this organization that Buckman started would be this far spread out throughout the whole world. At the end of the year, MRA workers returned to the task of establishing a lasting peace. In 46, they bought a large derelict hotel in Cau, Switzerland. Is that how you pronounce that? Cau. And that's still one of their headquarters. They have a place in Michigan and a place in Switzerland. They're very small now. And it became the center for reconciliation across Europe, bringing together thousands, including German Chancellor Adenauer, French Foreign Minister Robert Schuman. Its work was described by historian Douglas Johnson and Cynthia Sampson as an important contribution to one of the greatest achievements in the entire record of modern statecraft, the astonishingly rapid Franco-German reconciliation after 1945, where they got those two nations to peacefully work out all the problems that came from World War I and World War II. Under the following decades, MRA's work expanded across the globe, but particularly in Africa and Asian countries, moving towards independence. And I found this interesting. In 1956, King Mohammed V of Morocco sent a message to Buckman. I thank you for all you have done for Morocco in the course of these testing years. Moral rearmament must become for us Muslims as much as an incentive as it is for you Christians and for all nations. So you see, now it's reaching Muslims. The principles behind this were very popular, and they, you know, were catching on. Cyprus was another. Okay, well then one thing before we get to AA. This is just a clipping that I got, and it was MRA Week in New York. And they decided to hold this big MRA Week. And they got sports celebrities to be part of it. And the only reason I bought this so I could read who were the guys that were supporting MRA in 1939, Babe Ruth, Joe DiMaggio, Grantland Rice, Gene Tunney, Bobby Jones, Glenn Cunningham, Devereaux Milburn, polo player Milburn was unaware that the document had anything to do with religion. I forgot to mention that Buckman would use your name if you nodded that maybe you were interested in anything to do with peace. Then you were part of the moral rearmament movement as far as he was concerned. And so one of his things was celebrities. He felt that he personally enjoyed being around celebrities. There's photographs of him with everybody. It's like that movie where that guy was everywhere. Yeah, that's it. Um, So now we come to the connection with Alcoholics Anonymous. And you've got to realize that when Bill and Bob met, they were both going to the Oxford group. And if they weren't both going, this thing might not have worked. And we know how Bill got there because Ebby came over and dragged him down to the mission, and then Bill got interested. But most people don't know how Dr. Bob got in and how it got started in Akron. And for this, we have to go to a guy named James Newton. Newton was an assistant, but he's a brilliant guy. He wrote a book called Uncommon Friends, and it turns out he was like the private closest friend and person you bounce problems off of with Henry Ford, Firestone, the inventor down in Edison, Charles Lindbergh, and a Nobel Peace Prize doctor set up how to treat wounds during a war. And in other words, Charles Lindbergh would fly down to Florida and spend a month with him just to calm down and talk over things and all this. So this guy is like this close to all those people. And he was working for Edison, and Firestone came down to visit Edison, and Firestone said, I'm looking for a right-hand man, somebody that can really help me with my company. And he said, here's your man, Jim. And he went out there, and after 2 years, Firestone wanted to give him the business. That's how much he trusted him. He was that good. And on a business trip, James Newton noticed that Firestone's son was an alcoholic, Bud Firestone. And he also was a member of the Oxford group himself and had seen a few alcoholics recover in the Oxford group. So he invited Bud Firestone to go with him on a business trip. And while they were on the trip, they went off to an Oxford group weekend. And it impressed Bud so much, he got sober and stayed sober. So after 6 months go by, his father is going, geez, you look wonderful. What happened? He said, well, I joined the Oxford group. What's the Oxford group? Oh, it's this thing, it's catching on, it's all over the thing, Frank Buckman. Well, Firestone goes back and calls up Frank Buckman and said, I want you to bring Oxford group to Akron, and I wanted to be a big deal. And so they brought 60 people out, and they announced it in all the newspapers that this Henry Firestone wanted the Oxford group to come to Akron. Everybody come. So sitting at home is Henrietta Seiberling. She reads about it. Ann Smith reads about it. Well, I'll get Dr. Bob over there. This will be good. Do you follow what I'm saying? And so it was a major thing in all the papers, and the church that it was held in, the first big thing in Akron was, the minister was this name, Walter Tunks, which is part of AA history. That's the name that Bill called when he was in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel. And it's the minister who said the graveside service for Dr. Bob. And so they held this great event, and they started this meeting in the Williams home. And Dr. Bob and Ann Smith had been going there when Bill Wilson arrived in Akron and called up Reverend Tunks. He chose his name off of the list of ministers because in Vermont, Tunk meant to take a long walk. So the name meant something to him, and he called him up, and then that started the chain of names to get to Henrietta Seiberling so that Bill and Bob could get together. So you can see If nothing else, as far as you and I are concerned, the Oxford Group and Moral Rearmament saved our lives, because they put this coincidence that happened, this plan. Okay, so that covers AA. And then we were discussing earlier the separation, eventually, of Alcoholics Anonymous from the Oxford Group as the alcoholics became independent. And in New York, they became vocal, and the Oxford Group was delighted to get rid of them. In Akron, they were much closer, but as they became numerically in charge, there was more drunks than non-drunks, then, they wanted the meeting to talk about drinking, and it sort of deviated from the traditional Oxford Group and eventually broke away. We got our independence, and at the same time, Bill was constrained from thanking them, from, as he talked about the history of AA, from being able to say, we never would have made it if it wasn't for Frank Buckman. The spiritual practices, I jotted down the things that, to be spiritually reborn, the Oxford Group had four practices: the sharing of our sins and temptations, surrender our life, past, present, and future, into God's keeping, restitution to all we have wronged, and listening for God's guidance. So they had the four parts. Later on, after the Bill was there, he added two to these and ended up with six. So the six didn't come from, there were four in the Oxford Group, and then Bill added two. And they had six principles that he was using when he was making the list that turned into 12. Here's another point that I want to make. We say that AA's birthday is 1935. June 10th, 1935. Ask anybody. When's AA's birthday? June 10th, 1935. There was no AA in 1935. There was no AA in 1936. There was no AA in 1937. What the hell are we doing? They decided to backdate it. It's the only way to explain it. It's too complicated to say AA started in 1939, but it actually started in 1935 when they were part of the Oxford, so they just go, forget it. AA's birthday is 1935, even though we didn't come into existence until 1939. So if that helps you with your history. But it's an important distinction that we got to always remember that those first three or four years was all under the guise of the Oxford Group and their principles, and we hadn't put together the big book, and there's no such thing as a sponsor. There's all that didn't exist yet. Okay? Boy, we're getting through it. I don't know about you, I'm bored already, but I'm going to keep going. The best part's coming up, the sex. You see the room come alive? He said, sex, okay, hey. I'll go to the bathroom later. Okay, the five C's. This is part of the Oxford Group. Confidence, confession, conviction, conversion, continuance. That was just a way that Buckman had of capturing by using the same letter, the five C's. And then the four absolutes, honesty, unselfishness, love, and purity. And there was a great debate about including the four absolutes in AA. And in Akron, they wanted to keep them. They wanted it to be part of the program. We would say, Yeah, we have the steps and we also have the four absolutes. But the people in New York didn't like it. They didn't like anything like perfection or absolute, anything that set goals too high, because they figured new alcoholics would get discouraged. Absolute purity, absolute. I don't think I can do that. Whereas out in Akron and Cleveland, they felt it was fine because they understood you weren't going to get there. It was just a goal. And so Bill's sway, we didn't include him. But they still include it in Cleveland and in Akron. And there's pamphlets on the four absolutes published by the Cleveland Intergroup, and it says AA on the back because they started before New York did. So who's going to tell them they're wrong? You follow what I'm saying? They had an intergroup and were writing pamphlets before New York could find their way to the bathroom. And speaking about New York and Akron, Akron and Cleveland were much more religious sounding than New York. New York was much more philosophical, and then we'll start moving into the God thing a little later, whereas out in Akron and Cleveland, it was, welcome to God, get on your knees, we're going to say a prayer. Are you ready? Now, in a letter about 10 years later, Bill was writing that while we made fun of what they were doing in Akron and Cleveland, their recovery rate was twice ours. That says it all. Their recovery rate was twice that of ours in New York. And so that's when they decided to emphasize God more. But there's still no comparison between New York and Akron and Cleveland. It's slower. You might be at a meeting and somebody goes, don't talk about God too much, it'll scare away the newcomer. That's a sentence that I've heard for years. I haven't met the newcomer that was scared away, but they went to Cleveland. Yeah. Just teasing. Every time I do this, the New Yorkers show up after the meeting. We want to talk to you. And if they bring two guys from New Jersey, I know I'm in trouble. Now, the other thing, two things left, is guidance, that was really a major thing, where the group would sit quietly for 20 minutes, 25 minutes. They would have decided what they were looking for guidance on. Well, do you think we ought to stay in this location, or should we look for another place, or should we do this? Let's wait for guidance. And then they would sit quietly until someone felt that they had just received some kind of an answer, and they would speak up and say, I was just moved to say that we should stay where we are, or whatever it is. And then the discussion would go around the guidance that that person felt. And you would do the same thing for yourself. If you were wrestling with a problem, you would simply go outside and sit by a table and wait 30 minutes and then see what happened. Now, since most of us haven't sat for 30 minutes, we know due to contempt prior to investigation that it wouldn't work even if we did sit for 30 minutes. Some of us prove things that way. I know it wouldn't work without trying it. And yet, you would be totally surprised how many times you would end up receiving some kind of an inspiration that would lead you to make a different decision. So it's a very powerful thing called guidance. Sharing is another thing. The sharing that we do in step five was done in front of the whole group, especially in sexual matters. And this caused a few problems around the world. Not, it wasn't just that you had to do it, it was that you had to sit and listen. And so AA did not adopt that. We share with one other person and God, and we find that embarrassing enough, much less my entire home group. Woo. If that guy Ralph knew that, he'd bug me for the next 20 years. I don't want him to know my business. Now, here's a couple of things that I'm getting near the end here. Frank Buckman was Mr. Celebrity. He was the moral rearmament man. He was the Oxford Group man. He was the one. He came up with these four absolutes. He came up with pamphlets. He came up with all these various things. But every group was completely autonomous, just like us. They can come out with whatever, and we go, well, that's very interesting, but we like the way we're doing it now. And so the meeting in the Williams home in Akron was little affected by something that Frank Buckman might say. They were there, they had their routine, they had the readings that they did, and the meeting lasted an hour and a half, whatever it was, and newcomer came, they were welcomed, the wives came with them. So each group really was taking these principles and applying it in the best way that they saw fit without explicit guidance from Frank Buckman, even though he set up the parameter of the whole thing. And so we see the similarity in Alcoholics Anonymous with the autonomy of the groups. One of the great traditions that Bill Wilson came up with. Each group is totally autonomous unless what we're doing could mess up the reputation of AA as a whole. And even there, we don't have the power to tell the group to stop. There was a group in Richmond that was serving beer. And the reason they were serving beer was that everybody was a whiskey drinker, and when you ordered whiskey, you got free chasers, ginger ale, wine, beer, whatever. And they figured the chasers don't count. It's the whiskey that makes you an alcoholic. So we'll just serve beer. And of course, they got letters from New York, and we don't think it's a good idea. The other groups... But no one came and said, you cannot serve beer in this group because we don't have any policemen to go out and do that. Bad ideas fall of their own weight. People forgot where the meeting was and they would get lost. Pretty soon people just drank and didn't go to the meeting, and that was the end of that group. And so... But we did have our autonomy. Eventually, Frank Buckman died, another guy took over. And it started to lose, without a real dynamic leader, sometimes something that relies on, as they did, heavy publicity, lots of celebrities and important people, relying on promotion instead of attraction. When there's no more promoter, it's going to start fading. And so I'm going to read this. This is from back when President Eisenhower was in office. And this is the quote that I have here. The cultural and educational group Up With People can trace its roots to a song with the same name and a worldwide reform movement called Moral Rearmament. The founder of MRA was a Tucson winter visitor named Frank Buckman. He was a Pennsylvania pastor who believed God could rule the world through direct communications with men. The four absolutes were there, and unselfishness and love, had no creed or church affiliation. It was founded in 1938 and had an outgrowth of early Buckman organizations. 58, Buckman purchased 11 acres in the Catalina foothills. At the time, Tucson became the winter headquarters of MRA. Buckman and his organization had a cadre of well-known, influential followers, and his Tucson estate saw many of them come. Included in the visitors was Ramahan Gandhi, grandson of Mahatma Gandhi, the Prime Minister of Burma, one of the big senators from the Diet in Japan, and niece of the President of Vietnam, the Shah of Iran. Rezi Paivai named Buckman a commander of the Order of the Crown of Iran. Buckman died in 1961. The work of MRA had a new leader, J. Blanton Belk. He called for using the nation's youth to shape new values. America's in the crisis of its life. It can only be overcome in the conscience of each American. Belk created sing-out groups around the world. One of the songs the youth sang was Up With People. And some of you probably remember hearing that group band, Up With People, but you didn't know it was from the MRA. He retired from the MRA. He incorporated Up With People as a nonprofit corporation in 68. The fortune of the two groups were headed in opposite directions. Moral Rearmament was foundering, and Up With People was living and moving on. And so the last thing I found with Moral Rearmament was May 2013. This is to announce the 2013 Moral Rearmament Initiatives of Change Nigeria Training of Trainee Workshop. And they go on to describe a workshop that's being held in Nairobi, training people on spiritual matters in Nairobi. And it goes on to say there'll be 25 people and that the MRA is sending the people over. So in various small, isolated incidents, the MRA is still active, but certainly not in the scope that we'd ever hear about it. You'd have to Google and find one little workshop that's being held for the whole year. But it's still, the ideas were good, and the principles live on in Alcoholics Anonymous and have done amazing, wonderful things. There's a lot of detractors from Buckman because he was so celebrity-oriented and would exaggerate his closeness. You know, he's one of these guys that probably in his house he had a picture of him with every president of the around the world and the Pope and this and that. And if you went and said to the Pope, do you know Frank Buckman? Never heard of him. Well, your picture's in his house, and he looks like you're his best friend. And so that was probably one of his character defects, that this made him feel more important. But it also had succeeded as a strategy for promoting this first century Christianity, that people are, like you and I, are influenced by celebrities. And if we know that I can go get a glimpse of whoever your favorite sports figure is by attending this thing, and then I go there, and then I like it, then I find that my life was changed, you know, and that wasn't the reason that I went there. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's all I know about the Oxford Group and moral rearmament, and I thank you for sitting still this long, and we'll take a 15-minute break. And ah.